My name is Wyatt Laser Reed. Mm-hmm. I first turned myself in to the Sheridan camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stayed there for about around almost 2 years.
Okay.
And then from there, I went over to SeaTac Seattle for a while, then Oklahoma City, and then finally to Inglewood, Colorado, where I stayed the rest of my sentence.
Mm.
I'm home back in Portland.
Congratulations on coming home. That's a lot of places to be transferred, four places.
Yeah.
How long have you been an artist, or do you see yourself as an artist?
Yeah, I see myself as an artist. I guess I've been doing art since I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
but I really started taking it serious when I was in my junior year of high school and kind of slowly started taking it more serious by the time I was in my senior year. I got accepted into Pacific Northwest College of Art.
Mm.
And I think when I went to art school for a little while, I started kind of taking it more serious and doing kind of gallery work and stuff like that. And then dropped out of art school to kind of pursue. I was doing music too. I've recorded a couple hip hop albums, stuff like that. And ever since, I've been taking it pretty serious.
It sounds like creativity is really important to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my identity, mm-hmm. and as an artist. But I lived in Georgia for a while, from 12 to 18, and I kind of started kind of getting into kind of world of crime. And that's always kind of intersected into my life of art. And so now it's like I'm finally kind of seriously just focusing on art. I guess mm-hmm. for a long time I've been, you know, doing crime stuff. Now it's pretty much all art.
In your essay, you said you decided to get clean and devote yourself to creating art to take you back to a meaningful identity. That word meaningful was powerful to me. Because I think identity is always meaningful, but there's a distinction here, right? About how being clean and a devotion to art is equated to like a meaningful existence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that distinction for you?
I guess all my world in drugs or in the world of, I guess you could say brokenness has kind of now added to my art in a lot of ways. So taking from that, I found more meaning maybe when I was in art school. The technical approach of art in itself had meaning to me, but I wasn't really painting from a source of the why. Maybe now some need to rectify from the world of the broken or shattered self that I kind of draw inspiration to be able to articulate that, whether it's music or I'm painting or, you know, but I'm now it's like I'm trying to put that into my canvas work, where it's not just an aesthetic. It's more a deeper thing that I'm trying to convey, this distorted, you know, scattered identity, scattered self, you know, world from the broken, and how to convey that message out. That's why more than anything, why I've gotten into writing, because through my art, you know, there's a visual sense of being able to allow people to see what they see into the visual side of art. But when I write, I kind of can specify on the why and, you know, zero in on a specified kind of message. So I think now that's kind of why writing has also become important to my creative outlets, because I want to explain the why of that, the why people become broken or why people decide to delve deep into some tunnel. You know, what is the reason for escape? And so for me, you know, and why how I describe it, or a salvation and escape. When do you finally hit a bottom that makes you want to rectify or explain to others or find a commonality to where someone else can also say, well, it's meaning to me, or that that gives me meaning, or that gives me purpose, or that gives me a reason to rectify my own brokenness. So now that's why writing has become kind of meaningful to me now.
I hear the devotion that's like dripping in your words here, and it's really kind of, it's inspiring. Yeah. In your essay, you talked about teaching art class and how it was a struggle to get into that art class, and then how ultimately you started teaching that art class. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And has this move to understanding the correlation between written expression of art and visual expression of art come from that place, or is it somewhere else that it came from?
I guess first, I also taught like a creative writing class as well. I think what I found the difference from the writing class to the art class was that the art class people, most people weren't finding a need to create because they were trying to become technical enough or have a reason to create because they wanted to be seen or some aspiration to become famous as an artist or something. It was just a need to create, find an outlet of expression. But the writing class, I found that because I was at a camp in the beginning, I was around, I'd say, you know, more than 50% of the people there were white collar criminals. And I think there was a theme that most people were trying to create, like this Wolf of Wall Street biopic. And so I kind of, in that category or that group, I saw a need for creative expression to find identity, like the ego identity. And the visual thing was finding an escape of trauma, like a more of an art therapy. And because I was at a camp that the level of custody of it was, it's not fenced, so there still was a lot of stuff going on. I've had two identities for a long time. And so I myself was kind of finding my own path. And that's what I guess I took from the writing class to the art class, that because I myself was kind of trying to find my identity, my path, and more of my purpose through it, that what writing became because of teaching people who wanted to be able to tell some ego identity biopic that I was trying to write for a different reason. Writing for me was just like, I was writing a lot of screenplays and whether I was ever going to do anything with them or just to do them, just to be a creative outlet, there really was no deeper meaning. They all had the same kind of theme of some kind of Tarantino-ish crime story or whatever, and the focus on dialogue, learning dialogue. But then seeing how many people want to identify themselves as something that gives them identity, not as a creative outlet or having a greater state, I kind of looked at it as, are you guys writing about something that here's my capers and here's how I want to be seen as having purpose because of my great crimes committed, or is there a redemption story? And so that got me to, in my own internal dialogue, as I, you know, I'd like to write differently than like a screenplay, writing about redemption kind of themes. And to understand the way I want to write, I figured I could begin to work on a memoir and be utterly honest. And so I've been, you know, for a while now writing this kind of memoir. When I'm writing other things, they come from that vein of how I'm trying to write, the way I am trying to express, like the way I paint in colors and textures, and to be able to do the same thing with word and to create a texture and a color field kind of feeling of emotion. And for me, that comes out of being able to write about my own internal storyline of the whys and the brokenness. And so everything else I write, and you know, and what I got out of teaching the art class, because all these guys were looking for a different form of escape. They were looking for a positive form of escape and something that was like therapeutically healing. And so how would I write something where it could still be humorous, it could still be dark, but I could still constantly underlie this inner turmoil, struggle to find sense of, you know? And so, yeah, that's basically what I got out of that whole experience. So when I talk about what that educational purpose of finding identity was for me, you know, and what I think for most people who are really doing like the internal work, that's what it is. That's like the deeper form. And you know, when I went to Inglewood, I found that when I took a writing class there myself, and it was a Pan America, you know, themed syllabus writing course. And we all got books from Pan America and the whole thing. And so I kind of like internalized, like, oh, wow, now I'm actually in prison with this writing workshop that is based on people from prison and people who've gotten out and written, you know, themes of, you know, like Orange is the New Black or whatever.
Yeah.
People writing their own memoirs. And it's all the same struggle. Like, we're all pulling from the same vein of telling our own personal stories, but thematically they're all very, you know, similar parallel of the same story of redemption. And so when I was writing in that class, when I would read things, I was basically trying to get feedback from people who are shared in the same experience I was, and does what I'm writing convey that? And you know, I think a lot of the people there were like, oh, wow, you know, you're really being able to kind of in a different form of writing, express this same type of storyline in a different way. So yeah, that's probably what I got from all of what, you know, that education of identity could be, is identifying yourself so much, so honestly, that someone else can see in their own struggles, turmoil, what that is. For a lot of them, you know, they were learning to get honest, real deeply honest with themselves, and that was giving them inspiration to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And you know, that's kind of what I got from what writing was, especially in that atmosphere, is, you know, how honest can you be to yourself, you know, and then what will you get from that beyond the writing? And then for myself, okay, this is how far I want to go. This is how someone reads it, they can be like, holy shit, this guy is being like utterly fucking honest with everything. So there is no, the transparency there is, you know, almost humbling, because, well, he's humbled himself to be completely, this is written the grime of it.
I think T.S. Eliot wrote, "The dog barked backwards once and the man thought about when he was a pup." I think living in that kind of like utter nowness is such a hard thing for human beings, right? He also wrote, human beings can only take so much truth.
Yeah, right. So, and then there was another thing, like becoming sick with experience.
Okay, tell me more.
And yeah, like, you know, for a long time, I even look at like crime for me. It wasn't necessarily about how I want to be identified. I mean, like most people, I got to a point where I was stockpiling shoes and Louis Vuitton bags and that kind of level. But for me, it was excess. Everything, whether how I did my crime, how I did my drug addiction, everything, my form of escape was excess. And I wasn't realized till later. I hadn't realized that it was me. I was sickening myself with experience. And I didn't have a place. Well, you know, my art was that place, but at the time it was conveying excess. And now it's like I'm kind of unwinding what that is. Being sick with experience. At some point, you drown in it. You drown in that. You can only become so experienced in life before it just kind of becomes to strangle you with your own levels of need and more. And now it's like I'm trying to unpack that and, you know, in my actual life, not take in more, which is, you know, that's a daily chore for me because I'm still, I don't operate like I used to, but a lot of my instinctual need for more is still there. And so, you know, constantly. So when I write, it's like I'm unpacking that art. You know, visual art does a little bit, but not the same way writing does for me. I think maybe writing more than my visual art, like maybe, I don't know if I would ever look at my writing as something that I would want to be the main thing. I want to be identified with my visual art, but writing allows me to unpack it. And if there is an outlet for me to be able to share that, then, then, you know, more the better. But for me, especially right now, what that is. So when I write, sometimes when I even put it out into the world, it's like I want to either share for feedback or share to say, well, you know, am I being able to express my own honesty with that?
It's powerful. A lot of people don't think so intentionally, especially in this age of like social media posts, about what they put out in the world. I think it's a nod to your character that you think so intentionally about what and how and where these things will go. I want to circle back to a couple of things that you've said to me today. One of them is this dualistic nature, this idea that there's two people residing in yourself, and how those sometimes ideals might go to war with each other or support each other. Or just now you said that there's some things that in light of this escape into excess that are your instinctual mode of being and how you're watching that. Can you tell me more about how you see that dualistic nature coming out in your work or in your relationships?
Especially right now because of my environment.
Yeah, your place of transition.
Yeah, I'm still surrounded by people that a lot like me, excessive like that, and wanting to remain there, which is a struggle for me because one side of myself is always wanting to be drawn back into it or have similarities there and have a connection to people like that to where that this is how I identify myself. But the struggle is constantly, you know, pulling back and then internalizing, like, well, this is where I need to put my focus. I guess the internal struggle is more of me identifying myself as an artist, because it's not about identity of being seen for the art. It's about this is how it allows me, this internal struggle every day for me, like this constant NA meeting that's going on, and my art is my higher power.
Yeah.
And so I'm able to constantly, once again, I have to do this serenity prayer to my art, to my creative side, so that I win this battle. And most addicts will say, you know, this is a cunning and baffling disease, and it will never end. I'm constantly, at times, drawing myself back into old, familiar habits, and then, oh, okay, I should write now, or I should pull out a sketchpad, because even if I'm still in this atmosphere, this will allow me to become internal with my own process, my own struggle. Which, you know, I'll be out of here by next month, so it's like I'll be able to decompress finally and just give sway to a side of myself that I just want to be constantly in, you know, and not have triggers around, you know, hurt people, places, things, where for me it still pulls that out.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's about ego, you know, sometimes my criminal side is like, and we do this the best, and you know, let's blah blah blah, let's get back, and then I have to pull back even more.
Yeah.
So it's being in an environment where I don't feel that trigger is probably going to be best advantageous to my.
There's a lot of people at the halfway house that are in points of transition, and not everybody's at the same point of honesty, right, or reflection, right, where you right. are.
And you know, I was yeah. there so long, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. that, you know, I mean, I'm 45 now, you know, it's like yeah. I was there probably more of my life devoted to that identity mm-hmm. than, you know, and I was always still creative in that period, but for, you know, so many, for so long, especially just when I was into drugs, mm-hmm. you know, there was a time where I was criminal. I was just an addict, you know, I got mm-hmm. into heroin, and I remember all my, especially my art connections, my gallery people, and they would always say, you know, because they're thinking like, well, you know, here's this place you can get to. Mm-hmm. And why aren't you trying to get there? You have the ability, you have the talent to get there. You're actually selling work.
Mm-hmm.
So what the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and also an obligation to them. Hey, we want to promote you, but you seem to not give a fuck. And I think for a while it was the not even fear of success. It was more this. Proving to myself I didn't give a fuck about the same material shit, not even the material shit, the life that, mm. you know, a mm-hmm. lot of people sought after. And so now it's like I'm making terms with that too. If you know, a lot of my art connections, I want to get there now, but in a different way. And it took me all this time to kind of process what that meant for me, mm. you know?
Mm. Mm. What would you tell other people who are still in that space of not there yet, but maybe thinking about it?
I don't even really know what you can say other than, I guess, writing why it's important is expressing your own process or internal struggle mm. or just being able to identify to someone that, like, well, here's how deep I went, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, in my drug addiction, you know, I mm-hmm. used to go to NA meetings and shoot heroin before I went to a meeting, and I'd take a 30-day key tag, you know what I mean? Because
yeah.
I'd still want that attention that, oh, I'm trying, but, you know, I'm completely in this mode of escape.
Yeah.
And, you know, so someone can identify, oh, wow, you know, you were really here, you know, I still don't have veins in my body, you know, because,
yeah.
I mean, and then as a criminal to say, oh, you know, I went to a federal prison, so, I mean, you know, this is something I did full wholeheartedly, you know, so it's not like, you know, I don't understand, but I would have never been able to say anything to my younger self or even myself a while ago, you know, because I was so immersed in that world. Mm. I think, so all I think you can do is not even lead by example, because I really don't think that has much merit to somebody who isn't ready to commit to something else. All I think you can do is I help someone identify, and if they see in that, oh, I identify with this person because they've been there and they're making a change, then, you know, by that, I think maybe that's the best way you mm-hmm. can mm-hmm. Say anything. It's just by, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, I've been here and this is just what I'm doing, and I'm not necessarily trying to lead by example. I'm just, this is what I'm doing, and maybe someone can get something out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to hit rock bottom. But I really don't think there's a rock bottom. I don't ever think, I think death is rock bottom mm. because you can't change from there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really think there's a rock bottom. Your next rock bottom can always be deeper and more hellacious. But mm. but to be able to identify with somebody that, oh, well, you know, it was a long time I was on my way to whatever rock bottom I was creating.
Mm.
You know, if someone yeah. hasn't been that far, they say, oh, wow, and that's deeper than I've gone. Then, you know, to say, well, how did you get back here? You know, that's the only identifier, I think, is someone to say, well, shit, you know, what gave you a purpose to live again?
I don't think we talk about that enough, that people need yeah. purpose.
I think that's why NA is different to me than, like, let's say harm reduction,
mm-hmm.
because I think, and it doesn't have to be drugs, it can be anything, that is an escape. Mm-hmm. And then you put harm reduction, you put damage control on that thing. Mm. And NA is still, even though they say, oh, this isn't about God, it's a God of your understanding. Well, I still feel like it's very religiously based, mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, something that got created out of the church because people that grew up in the church, this is how they found recovery. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes very black and white. And I think religion can be very black and white, heaven or hell, you know, all these kind of easy to be seen kind of stratospheres of good and evil. And recovery is such a gray area. I think brokenness is such a gray area. And, there, you know, there were times where, like, in NA meetings where I would bring up something really, like, some trauma that usually you wouldn't talk about in NA. And even if it wasn't my own experience, I would just want to see how that would play. And it would always make people so uncomfortable to talk about something that was really, like, what the fuck? You know, mm-hmm. what are you talking about? Why are you bringing this shit up?
Yeah.
And I think people just want to, like, if you really want to get attention in a NA meeting and you just go in and say, you know, wow, and I was at this bottom and I found a God of my understanding and now I got a job and now it's like this and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, black and white, because it's also a westernized culture disease. And it stems deeper than the drug addiction or the addiction. Our culture is so much in this idea of ego being perceived as, I was at this shitty place, and now I'm at this great place. I had no car, no money, and no one liked me. You know, everyone likes me. I have a car, and I have a house, and people give me attention, you know, and I think westernized culture is so much about, you know, the reason to be having a position in the world that is some material gain. I usually have never seen anyone come into an NA meeting and say, well, you know, I'm still a millionaire. And yeah. I still chip around on heroin, but I have a Lamborghini out front, and I have this, you know what I mean? I have a supermodel girlfriend, and I have this house I still own. I think it would be harder for people to identify, oh, fuck, what's the problem? You know, it's always the, you know, and then I was staying in this Roach Motel, smoking crack, and I had nothing, and now I have these new Jordan's on and I have a job, and it makes it easier for people to identify as a symptom seems to be the material gain from mm-hmm. this rather than the gain from being broken, you know, especially in this world, you know, the institutional type of justice DOJ system of what is wrong with addiction or criminal, you know, no one's really thinking there's a problem with the guy who is the Wolf of Wall Street guy.
Right.
And he still goes to the camp and I realized that, you know, I was rich. There really is no punishment. And I came out and still impressed people, even though people thought I was a rotten person and I, you know, didn't do the internal work. And I'm still materially successful and I'm still achieving the kind of aspirations most people, you know. And so I think that side of broken is really hard to identify because mm-hmm. especially now with our president, Elon, this world is a very, you know, that 1%. How do you even dismiss the brokenness of somebody who, well, I still, you know, have all this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think it's really hard when you look like societal success to identify emotional and like growth success
right.
internally.
Right.
Yeah. It's masked well. And I think that's why so many people have like midlife crises.
Right.
This
right.
dissonance.
Sometimes I think if I achieve some level of success in the future, and the first stuff I wrote or the first stuff I did and people identified with it or saw merit to it and it became, you know, it allowed me to achieve success. And then I got to a place where whether I was writing about my own personal or I was writing a story or I was doing art and I was saying, you know, I still decided to choose to be a rotten person. Mm-hmm. I just don't do drugs anymore, but I achieve.
Mm.
And the characters or the narrative to all my work is that I enjoy being a sociopath. You know, I think most people would honestly, you know, me and my mom talked about this to say, well, you know, in ways, you know, because of the dual identity kind of world you've been in, you know, you almost borderline sociopath without, you know, having the emotional compass to dictate what that actually is and not be a sociopath. But there would be merit in going that honest to say, well, you can articulate it. And most people aren't even able to articulate or want to be honest with what that is. And then if I imagine, well, and if I was able to do that, would anybody in the future, if I achieve success, say, oh, I still like this guy because he can be that honest with all his crazy shit, but he hasn't changed. He doesn't plan to change. So I think that's also a thing, is that how do we see brokenness? And if someone is still gaining or achieving success and then say, well, I choose to still be broken, but I've gotten to this place and I don't do drugs anymore. You know what I mean? So,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are your reasons to want to change? And is it actually, you know, your own internal reason? Not because, you know, people attach this idea of redemption to this thing and you've become a brand. So you have to project that, you know. Or, no, I choose to brand, you know, psycho artist who's still achieving and doing well to this thing. Mm-hmm. And so people, you know, so I think that's now like where I'm going is like the internal struggle is to say, well, you know, if you can still achieve it, especially in this westernized culture like this, what would be your real reasons to need to change other than just not fucking yourself off by, you know, doing the drugs you like to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because drugs don't have to be drugs at all. They could be whatever you put your time into to escape. I think that's a really powerful definition that you've provided us. Teaching inside is not something that people who are currently incarcerated often get to do in a lot of systems.
Right.
Do you think that there is value in being able to, one, be in a class, regardless if it's creative writing or art or whatever the medium might be, being able to give that back in that way to then teach the next class.
Would
you say to the people who say that it's not safe or, you know, there's a lot of policies that there's no peer-to-peer facilitation of programming allowed in some of these places. Yeah. So what would be your argument for a pro and a con for that? Because I like to think about all sides of things.
Well, I would say a pro would be to take first out of the, I guess, street. Because I think maybe sometimes writing and art or, you know, visual art, it comes out of this kind of, even though it's very excessive, it comes out of this kind of straight college educated world. You know, most people don't have experience in the criminal underworld as far as, you know, prison and this and that. So it then becomes this unknown. But I take it out of context of that and then say, well, what if you taught something that was culturally relevant to a group of people that pretty much is the same in or out? And that would be the tattoo culture.
Mm-hmm.
And people are tattooing in prison as just as much as they are on the outside. So then what if you started an apprenticeship and people from the outside who are still in the same culture of criminal outlaws, tattooing, rebelling against society, the art form itself is kind of a fuck you to straight society or what, and it's becoming very, you know, commercialized. And then you took that to prison and apprenticed people, and then it became a positive light because now guys who didn't really know how to change, you gave them an outlet which was still familiar to them, and then allowed them to learn how to tattoo. And then all of a sudden someone says, oh, well, now you're an outside thing for you and blah, blah, mm-hmm. and it made the conversion easier, but it didn't go out of their comfort zone.
Yeah. Actually, the Missouri Department of Corrections just started a apprenticeship program with a tattoo shop inside.
Yeah, so, yeah, because I was hearing about, you know, the emergence of programs like that, mm-hmm. and I thought, you know, wow, you know, it took them all this time to see, you know, something where the transferable skills. And so if you took that same thing where it's like, all right, what if you took the white collar guys that were in prison who had experience with prison and taught them fucking skills to become a real estate person, you know, or taught them business skills of whatever, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. they themselves, so you're kind of, transitioning the people teaching it who actually, you know what I mean, have experience in both worlds, and then taught them an actual trade. And so I think at times the conversion process is not the mode. I think the mode is sound. Anybody who's looking for education to have a skill set to transfer over here, over a fence, mm-hmm. and just be as technically proficient at anything you can learn. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And I think mm-hmm. you can learn everything and you put your time into it, like 10,000 hours into anything will make you a master of that thing.
Right.
But the problem is the transferable to the actual world in itself. And I think that's the problem, because it's mm-hmm. like you have to then... Like even myself, it's like, well, then how can people from this unfamiliar world to criminal or prison accept what I'm doing as an artist or this? And you have to turn yourself into a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the emotional understanding of that transferable skill of making you a commodity is the difficult part, because everything is still so black and white in prison, mm-hmm. and to understand, well, if some guy is, you know, becoming a jailhouse lawyer and he's learning everything about law and blah, 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 how can he transfer his side of this thing to turn himself into a brand of something that, you know, personifies redemption or mm-hmm. you can achieve anything? And then, so how would you go into a prison and teach not just the skill set, but this is how you have to sell yourself to the world now.
Mm. Mm.
So I think that's the difficult thing. And I think that's what square society doesn't want to deal with, that emotional baggage of, mm-hmm. well, these guys aren't going to be able to fucking sell themselves, mm-hmm. you know, and the best they can do is get a job at Dave's Killer Bread. Because they don't, and no one is teaching people the emotional fortitude to re-identify themselves. And I think that's the thing that's lacking from the whole justice process mm-hmm. of reintegration. And even in this halfway house, yeah. most of the people here, they don't even have that emotional aptitude themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just this very black and white, well, blah blah blah, and let me see your resume, and are you did it do? And then the guy just figures, well, I gotta shut the fuck up unless I run into another person who's like, mm-hmm. well, what did you go in for? I went in for robbery, you know. Oh, cool, I'll smoke cigarettes with you on breaks, you know, because that's how I'll still identify myself, because I don't know how to connect with these people and the person who's, you know, blah, blah, blah. So the jobs that are offered because mm-hmm. of that are very much not giving people a chance, because they don't want to deal with the emotional baggage of, am I just going to, is this guy going to remind me from somebody from fucking, you know, shot caller, you know,
mm-hmm.
is this guy like, holy shit, that tattoo looks real prison bound. Like, I'm guessing this guy is probably that person, and they're, you know, or is this person going to be able to have learned the skill set that even though he's still branded in such a way that he comes off and it's like, wow, when did this guy become emotionally evolved on top of the skill set?
Mm-hmm. Emotional aptitude is something that And this idea of the transference of this, what skills are valued or even recognized, right? That even though we've done all this work on the inside to develop some set of skills, I mean, 10,000 hours on anything is such a commitment that then that kind of work is not always recognized as work.
Well, I focus on my right. Oh, yeah. I focus on my art so much because, I mean, you know, at 45 years old, the one skill set I have, the one group of connections I have is to the art world, where I don't have this giant block of discrepancy between the last job I had where I wasn't dealing drugs and now, and to say to somebody, well, I am someone different than what you see here on this resume, but all of that is connected to my art world. And so for me, that's why on top of it, I put so much focus, because the one redeeming quality about myself to be able to sell myself to the world again is in my art. And yes, let me get a job and let me find something in between, but I'm not looking for the career because, in my honest opinion, that is not going to get me there. So I'm so honest. I'm not looking to do something that, for me, at the end of the day, this isn't where I want to put another 10,000 hours in.
Right.
I don't want to become a master forklift operator. Right. I don't want to become, you know what I mean? And I think for a lot of the normal kind of stereotypical redeveloping self criminals, that is something that their ego can identify that gives them purpose to say, you know, I mean, a lot of guys here, it's not that I have a job and I'm saving money. It's as to the other kind of look at I am somebody important, and this thing, they're going to move me up and I can identify. And so I think that's the hard part too, is that most people identify themselves easy enough to say, this gives me importance. And I think that's where the job field can manipulate somebody into apprenticeship before they even have time to say, well, here's what I really want to love to do.
Ooh.
But, well, you know, you're at this age and we can train you to do this thing. And are you going to actually be devoted to this other thing? You've been a fucking criminal most of your life and a drug addict. I mean, honestly, so it'd probably be better to take this culinary apprenticeship and become a cook at a, you know, at an Elmer's. And at the end of the day, I think the ego still struggles to identify, well, if I'm not going to be a drug dealer anymore, if I'm not going to be able to escape anymore, then my ego needs to have some sense of identity. And especially in this kind of environment where you're around other people just like you who all kind of read on the same aesthetic value of importance of self. And they say, oh man, this guy just got a Mustang with this job. Oh, he's making 20 plus dollars an hour. Man, he's still as important as this person as he was a drug dealer. And that's the transferable skill set. And then, you know what? I just saved enough money that I might be able to get a kilo. Because the emotional change has not happened to say, you know, I just saved this money and I'm thinking about buying into this apprenticeship to do this, or, you know, I've always wanted a tattoo. So, you know, when I went to tattoo school, that was $5,000, you know what I mean? And your good equipment is just as expensive. You know, at the end of the day, before I was actually in a tattoo shop, that was almost $7,000. You know what I mean? And that wasn't even including how devoted I was, or people who wanted to apprentice me, and then taking the time out of my day, you know, to do that. And you have to be dedicated to the new thing you want to do, even if it is as, you know, culturally, you know, familiar, like a tattoo apprenticeship. And if it's something else, it's even more unfamiliar. And they say, well, you can know, we've got these real estate class, blah, 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 you know, but, you know, it's $5,000 and da, 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 da. And then we give you the certificate. And then on top of that, you got to put the time in to, that's a big investment to where what's not familiar to somebody and without somebody, you know, and it definitely isn't the people in this halfway house who are going to be like, wow, that's the kind of goal set you want, since that's so the status quo for us. Let us put time into really helping you, since we only have another 100 fucking people. We got to focus on getting them a job at Dave's Killer Bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they have to themselves, if they do have family or friend who is going to support them, or for them just to have the faith in their own, you know, focus on what and who and what they're going to become, and then say, you know what, I'm not going to buy these new Jordans. You know, I got to say, you know, half the guys who actually have a dollar in their pocket, you know, even in this halfway house, they got 10, 15 pairs of Jordans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're wondering, you know, well, is it because you like to dress nice, or is that how you like to be identified? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I have just as many Jordans. But for me, I look at it like, you know, I'm having to reincorporate how I see myself in the world, and to be around, you know, similar people like me, that's not going to help me in this place. And then to focus my mind there, I might not think maybe I shouldn't buy another 10 shoes when I make some money.
Yeah.
So you have to really... Yeah. define and kind of unpack, like, you know, I do have 20 pairs of Jordans at the house, but maybe I should just grab a pair of Vans so I can identify myself as this person who's going to save every dollar I get, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Able to then say, well, if I identify myself as being this person, you know, because, you know, how I look at it, even in the material world, the people who got real money, they might have a Lamborghini or a Tesla or whatnot, but they jump out of the car and they got, like, you know, Walmart jeans on and a pair of Converse, and they got, you know, a million plus in the bank. So yeah. People who really got money, they don't need to identify themselves, because if it really is a thing about ego, they can say, homo, you want to pull out banks? So they know internally what their worth is, and people who don't internally know what their worth is in the world, they feel the need to project that. And so it makes it harder for them to then say, well, let me value my worth at this and then put my money here. Mm-hmm. And then that's where I put my money where my mouth is. So I think that's the problem. And because it's such a hard emotional transition, I just think the people at these halfway houses, they just... You know, you get the job, Dave's Killer Bread, and you're not getting high, and fucking great. That's, mm-hmm. you know, probably better than the majority, so.
Yeah. Yeah, but it doesn't have to be our limit. Though no. I will say, I love Dave's Killer Bread, for the record.
I think the whole thing is awesome, and I wish there was more places like that, with even the story to that. But, you know, like, you know, Dave has... fucked up a bunch of times, you know, since, but that's not the story they're selling. They're not selling, you know, like, hey, you fucking do Dave's Killer Bread and you can get to this place, and then you can get enough money where you can crash a fucking Escalade and, you know, blah blah blah, and you got money in the bank, you just fucking build a brand. It's still selling the brand. If you look on their website, or, you know, the page, it's like all these guys who were just like Dave at this place. The brand is you can come out of prison and be a good guy again.
Yeah.
And that's what they're selling connected to their bread. And their bread is fucking great. The product's great. So connecting the brand to the product is like, man, you know, when I eat this fucking bread, I think about all these guys who would have stabbed me in prison. And now they're like smiling and shaking my hand and fucking. So I wish there was more places where there was emphasis on that emergent, you know, kind of hero's journey. But I just think the hero's journey is, you know, mostly not going to be accepted in the mainstream, unless it's like the Wolf of Wall Street hero's journey.
Yeah. Well, also, like, you've brought up redemption a lot, and like the idea that redemption is like a destination that's final, versus a process that has ups and downs of it, right? Yeah. Or the idea that redemption is like the culturally accepted idea of redemption as like turned away from your old ways forever and ever is like the only version of redemption that can be, right? So what is your definition of redemption?
Mm-hmm. My current definition of redemption is... being integrated with the Joseph Campbell version of the hero's journey, the forever story of the hero's journey, the Jesus, Buddha, Siddhartha version of the hero's journey, because that's for any human story, I feel, that is the internal story of identifying with the human struggle. And the ones where it is that, and it is, I became broken, and I realized that all that glitters is gold, and then I became the person who is just floating the raft and people picking people up on the side and giving them, you know, transport to safer grounds. Even if it isn't that physical thing, and even if, you know what I mean, even if it just is, this is just how I live, and if someone else can get to safer grounds by seeing how I operate, then the better. But you know, that is the redemption story, is not even achieving, it's struggling to get there. And I think once you achieve it, like, when is the story over? When does somebody finish the last page of the book and say, fuck it, they got there. Oh my God, the movie credits go up and the music, and you're like feeling so inspired. And then you say, you know, he's kicking it with Dave's Killer Bread. They get, you know, he gets high with Dave's Killer Bread. They're crashing fucking Escalades all over Portland. So the redemption story is the constant, because every day, when especially you achieve some level of financial success with your redemption story, I think you have the choice to, you know, and people maybe won't judge me as much because I've achieved the thing. So, you know, I think it's, and then it's the internal struggle of what are my own reasons to stay there, and the hero's struggle, because every day you make an achievement by just not following the old path that's familiar. You take the road that is less traveled, and you say, you know, for me, this is what it took me today to get here.
That makes sense. That's powerful. I guess the last question I have, and then I'll just leave the floor to you to wrap us up, is, if there was one or two or some narrative that you wish you had seen or heard about on the inside while you were there, that would have helped you identify differently with what could be.
Yeah.
And maybe not for you, but other people who are inside. Like, I think sometimes the only narrative that is pushed back into these spaces of incarceration is that you'll only work a menial job, you'll never get a, you know, that you're just coming back, or, you know, like, and I think that's really far from the truth. There's a lot of people out here in their cycle of redemption and or their cycle of success, whatever that might look like for them, little, big, small, family, whatever it is. And I think that sometimes, like, those narratives that we, like, we're having this conversation here, right? And it's going to be showcased on a public platform here. And that, what would you want out of that to be pushed back inside so others can see, and something different than that same loop?
I mean, you know, when I was younger, I wish someone would have been able to, you know, even out of prison, break it down to me. I wish all the father figures I had weren't, this is how you need to get something in the world, son. This is how you need to be. No one's going to respect you unless you got it like this, son, you know. But I think the sad thing in prison is because the culture is so impoverished. I think when somebody really is showing somebody how to get it differently, you know, especially in prison, where like a honey bun has a value. You know what I mean?
I do.
Like a lot of people, like, if you can walk into it, like, I don't think I ever walk into a Safeway or a Fred Meyer's or something and not be like, you know how much I can get for those fucking Reese's Pieces on the side? So when things have value like that, I think it's so much the dog with the ball. Because somebody can show you this fucking Horatio Alger fucking story, this climb into fucking Mecca, this, you know, reaching the top of the mountain story, the hero's journey story, and saying, I got there just with this $8 typewriter ribbon, you know, or I got there with these cheap paintbrushes or whatever it is. But when someone else can say, you know, hey, son, you can't get these peanut butters at another prison. Like, you want to help me hustle these on top of it? I got a bunch of tobacco. And like, oh, my God, look at that guy. You know, like, he lives good. I think it's really hard for that story to be seen because the younger inmate, the inmate without nothing, the inmate who has always struggled coming from not just a broken place, but a broken environment. And then someone who has, who they also identify with, that they've had nothing. I think it's different too when you know people in prison are from a privileged family, especially in the criminal etiquette. No one gives them much props because they always question, like, oh yeah, you got a Benz, but did your mom help you out with that?
Right.
When the guy knows that, like, man, I know his mom be borrowing money from him and he's got a Benz. It's the same thing in prison when the guy knows, like, man, like, did you see his TruLink's commissary account? Like, that guy, you know, like Big Meech, the guy from Black Mafia Family, he was in Sheridan Medium, you know, and we'd always hear our little passed down stories about him at the camp. And constantly, anytime people were talking, you know, about how they had it or this or that, he'd like, hey, come over to this TruLink's computer real quick. And he'd tap, tap, tap and bring up his TruLink's account. And everyone said it was always that $99,999. And that's the max you can have the thing at. Yeah. And that lets someone know every day. No, not just like one day where it's like the thing's at night. Every day he kept that thing at $99,999 because he wanted to let somebody know, I am not without and I don't move for nobody. It comes to me. And people in prison respect that story more than the internal struggle or achieving something that really isn't measured with material wealth. So I think that's the real hard thing. And I think the outside world of those who have versus the have-nots, they don't understand that story internally, that struggle. So for them, they see it as, well, you know, these guys would just come back out and do whatever. And I think it's hard to change the narrative inside because it's hard to change what you aspire to have when you have nothing yourself to really sit down and, you know what I mean? So before I left, you know, I had a couple guys who were, you know, hey, can you show me how to hook up a typewriter ribbon? And hey, when you leave, can I get your typewriter ribbons, and you've inspired me to want to write, and that's, I always see you writing, and you are devoted to this thing, and being able to tell your story. And people in the writing class were really, I'm inspired to write better because you have showed that you can achieve this, your version of articulating this story that we can all. But I think at the end of the day, the guys who were inspired to start writing, they wanted to tell the crazy Wolf of Wall Street story, their version. And the guys who were already writing, they wanted to tell their crazy version of, you know what I mean? And I got to even say, you know, honestly, some of these guys, I'd be like, you know, you should write your story like this because your story, I mean, I don't know how much of it is true, but I mean, I'm going to turn that to a screenplay.
Right.
Because it still is a great story, but internally, what are you getting out of it? And is it helping you get to another place? And are you finding some redeeming quality? And I, you know, that's just I mean, that's the difficulties I found with educating, because most people, they look at that as a vehicle to get to this place, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think the most, I mean, especially from where I'm at, sometimes the most humbling thing, and I think something my mom's always, she had a lot of artist friends, would mm-hmm. always tell me, you know, like, all these guys are good, all these people are good, but you know how much of them actually have a dollar in their pocket? Mm. And son, let me tell you that becoming an artist has nothing to do with money.
Mm.
And I have very few friends who actually sell their paintings for lots of money. Right. Most of them are just as good with their style, but they don't sell work like that. Will you be committed to this craft, even though most likely there will never be financial success? There may never be real recognition. You may only be held in high regard to the small group of like-minded people. Maybe there might be a few patrons of your work. In that world of people who are not criminal and not mm-hmm. drug addicts, and even a lot of artists are drug addicts, because they haven't come from the prison world, and that, I think you just compound the fracture more and more. Are you mm-hmm. going to be devoted to this thing, even though there's no vehicle to get to the other side, that mm-hmm. you'll actually be able to identify yourself as successful? It'll just be this internal storyline where you're constantly trying to achieve this thing. No one else is going to look at you in a group where, unless you put on a pair of fucking Jordans or have a Benz outside, be able to say, man, why do you always have those notebooks? No. Someone might be able to say, wow, God, wow, you can really, how long have you been drawing? But most of them are never saying, wow, you can really, how long have you been drawing? They're saying, how long do you have to do that to get good at it? And can I do it, like, can I be good at it tomorrow? So that's the thing. I always see that people who, it's not really, like, unless I'm with like-minded people, people are like, is this something that maybe I can get attention with or get somewhere with it? Mm-hmm. And how long did it actually take? If I told someone, like, hey, I just picked this shit up today. You know, yeah. Like, man, I just picked up this little big pen on the floor and I just started doing this. Man, you can do this. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the thing, is that people don't want to invest time to anything that's mm-hmm. not like, you're going to get this paycheck at Dave's Killer Bread and you might be able to, with four of them, you know, buy half a kilo of Coke and start making real money and get a Benz. But, you know, what you'll get out of it, and that's, you know, the hero story. And I just think that's the hard transferable skill to what I learned in prison, the education. The people that were really doing it, the people that were teaching my writing class, mm-hmm. the people that were doing law work, mm-hmm. most of them who were really, for a reason that was internalized, were doing it all pro bono.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it because their own storyline, or not even those people inside, the people connected to the whole justice system, the people I've met at Volunteers of America or this or NA, the people that I know well and I have faith in their mission statement, they were doing it mostly pro bono or to make pay the bills, mm-hmm. to put braces in their kids' teeth, and other than that, nothing over the top. And they were doing it because their brother died in prison and the other one died an addict. Mm-hmm. And I usually ask people too, in the justice system or the world of psychology or anything to do with drug education, I say, do you have any family who mm-hmm. has, because it right away allows me to understand if the mission statement is sound and something that is not to be attained, because are you trying to become a psychologist like this so you can get to this place because you work in the wrong crowd, you know? Or is the reason you're doing it as good as you are, you know? And that was the thing when I was at Volunteers of America. Most of the counselors, and they tended to hire good-looking women and very educated, and a group of guys who were not well-educated, who were very submissive to women, you know what I mean, differently than if I hired. And it was smart. But at the end of the day, most of the counselors in a place like that, when I would really internalize something, would say, and almost defeated, in a defeatist attitude, say, well, what the fuck can I help you with? Man, you should, you know, like, your graduation day is here. Like, love to listen to you, but what can I, you know, because it's easier to help the person where we still, most of them didn't have any of their own. Actually, no, I take that back. Most of them who were doing it for the reason had the family member who was an alcoholic or this. And then the rest of them, it was just a stomping ground until they could get to John Hopkins Hospital or something. You know what I mean? So I think you lose the good teachers and the good everyone in the field, especially in the justice department, you know, because if they're really good and they're educated, then everything is just a stomping ground to get to. And it looks real good on a resume if you had something to do with the rehabilitation world in any sense, you know, justice department, drug education. It looks real good on a resume that, you know, I helped out these fucking guys and got them to Dave's Killer Bread.
Well, let's talk about your mom for a second. Do you mind? I have had such great interactions with her. I know
she wouldn't mind.
Yeah. She even sent me a picture of you as a kid with her. Said, I can't include it, but it was just so cute. She's so devoted to you. And I'm really glad that she could keep your studio while you were inside. I mean, that, you know, I am also formerly incarcerated, so I come to this work honestly.
Yeah, mission statement.
Yeah. I truly believe access to education in whatever form that might manifest in is a means to self-reflection in the ways that you have identified as, like, redemption, and that that cycling of a cycle that is what success looks like, even if it doesn't look like cultural's idea of success. So I appreciate you taking the time with us. But to your mom, I just want to say one mad props to your mom for just being that, you know, point of stability, even though relationships with moms are always complicated. But I also want to ask, what does incarceration or this process of redefining yourself or identity or, you know, art or anything you want to input in that space of that could be a word, what does that mean in relationship to your family?
Yeah, I wouldn't just say for me it's much easier because a lot of guys, their family are from it in some sense. But, you know, my mom's from the Bronx in 1970s, you know, like 1960s, 1970s, the Bronx. She's, you know, made her bones, per se. She has experimented with heroin.
She's,
you know,
lived it honestly too, huh?
She lived it and did it and had all kinds of dysfunctional relationships along the way, that and she makes her transparency to her fucked up past and all her achievements, you know, it's all, I'm able to be really honest with my mother. And so she's able to honestly see all of the messiness and the achievements very easy. And I think you have to have an advocate who you can be honest to. Because having an advocate who's, they just want to see it black and white. You know, mom, I've been going to NA meetings, or like, dad, I just saved up enough money to get a car. And to have someone who really honestly knows, like, every day is a struggle for you. And that when you're doing good, that's a monumental achievement. Because they know that, you know, I think even in my writing, I'm able to be more honest. Because my mom was almost like, you know, let the world know you're a borderline sociopath, because it allows you to be more honest with yourself.
Yeah.
And when you have someone, an advocate, who even knows you have a lot of distorted self, but that, and that's interesting. And if you have the emotional ability to process, and that's all interesting, and it's, and that's going to be a lifelong process, but you should do it, and you should do it, and you should do it. You know, you have to have that advocate who's going to know you honestly and be able to tell you that, you know, there's nothing you should shame yourself about. And I think a lot of times in recovery in general, you're reforming a fractured thing, you know, whether it's actual physical, a broken leg, you have to heal that thing. And so when you're not able to honestly do it, you're not honestly putting the cast on all day, and you have someone who's going to kind of say, no, it's all right, just take it off when you're fucking playing some basketball.
Yeah.
Or a person who's going to honestly believe, even though, like, is that blood coming out of the cast? But the cast is still on. No, you look good. Like, oh, no, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you have to have someone that you can honestly say, like, well, blah, 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 to where it's still a process for the healing, and mm-hmm. the fracture is still there. And I don't know if the fracture is ever going to go away, but I'm constantly trying to heal the thing. Mm-hmm. That you have someone who's going to be an advocate to say, well, you know, I'm impressed because you're still doing more healing. And, you know, it doesn't matter that if you still have a broken leg without a cast on and you're achieving something, oh, you just won this tournament. But, you know, like, at some point, you're going to have to cut the fucking leg off.
Yeah.
You can't have someone who's just going to, like, respect the fact you're achieving something, even though this fracture is not getting any better. And at some point, you know what I mean? So yeah. I think for me, that's what my mother is, because my father is, you know, at one point, my father, when never being around in my life, was having the most kind of distorted male relationship. You know, he wanted to build a cannabis company with me, mm-hmm. you know, and in the place I'm at now, he's nowhere to be found. Wouldn't want to talk about anything to do with this.
Yeah.
Especially male relationships, you know what I mean? They have that level of material kind of respect for success. Hmm. And so, you know, I think sometimes it's even harder with fathers, especially for, you know, guys coming mm-hmm. out of prison, because they don't have someone who's going to be an advocate to be honest about the fracture. And I think in America, the American story doesn't respect, I feel like a failure. It's hard to admit I feel like a failure, I'm a failure. Or, you know, America's still like, I got the broken leg, but I won the championship. Like, fucking hoorah, you know? So to have someone who's going to, you know, respect your work, even if they honestly know. I know, honestly, the odds are against you. You're probably never going to achieve what you dream to achieve. But the fact that you strive to get there, that's honorable. And, you know, I commend you for that, you know. And I think in a lot of ways, I think, you know, you have to have that, because you got to have someone still rooting for you, even if they know.
Yeah.
Even if they know, the odds are really just against you. And now, especially from the justice system, you're a felon now. Like,
yeah.
Geez, you couldn't have stacked it any harder on yourself. Ex-drug addict, criminal, and the main line of occupation, you know, is, yeah. you know, going to put you back in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah, I think you got to have that.
Yeah. It's always curious to me that we have this idea of you know, the felon being the mark of no longer being able to make it anywhere in society. Where in America specifically, I think the number is now 1 in 12 individuals has a felony record, and 1 in 3 African-American males. But then again, like, whose felonies are whose? I think your nod to the Wolf of Wall Street is really pertinent in this time, that what we see or define as these things, I think that's been the biggest part of this conversation for me, is just rethinking how we define these cultural norms as metrics of success or metrics of redemption. And I appreciate
the idea that you go to Club Fed is kind of like, oh, you got away with your crime, it's like push you in a vacation home. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this idea that you're still winning, you know, and especially the camp I was at, you know, they called it Sheridice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the guys were still making money.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found that was the norm was that none of these guys who knew how to make money or live excessive had any real goal set.
Mm.
There's no reason to save money. And most of them, I don't have kids. Mm. Most of these guys, whether they're in their 20s or 30s, they all got one kid, two kids, three kids. And as soon as they make a couple thousand dollars, you know, even while still being in prison, even being in a place where, like, well, this is still realistic and not getting in trouble and have the guards cracking down on our head, like, shouldn't you be saving every dollar you get? And then as soon as they make a couple thousand, they start getting high. And it's not even like, well, I'm getting high and I'm hiding. And it was like, well, let me show you how excessive I can be, because now I'm just going to go off the rails all day long and show you that I'm spending money and I'm buying $5 candy bars. And I beat you because this is how ridiculously insane I can spend. And and so and that's still respected. You know, that idea is still respected, that this guy can live excessive and still be in here and still be a wheeler and a dealer. And at the end of the day, when I left there, you know, I got in some trouble. And I even stopped telling people the story of the why, because there was, for one, there was this respect, and then there was this expectation to still be that guy. Well, hey, if you can do it over there, you can do it over here. And then I stopped identifying myself as this person. And yeah, I can still do these things. And yeah, I understand the hows and the whys of the whole thing. And maybe I know it better than most. But this is how I want to identify myself. And what really helped me do that is that I stopped. More than ever, I stopped really believing in the criminal that really has any aptitude to turn it into anything. What I really find is that the majority of criminals will talk the big game, but at the end of the day, I didn't want to focus on doing that anymore with people that aren't just, this is a losing battle altogether. So in a lot of ways, I kind of lost my value in the system because I didn't find similar people like me. And the ones that were way too in it than me. They didn't have any other thing that they did to where they were in it with both feet. And which I guess, you know, if you're going to do anything, do it with 2 feet put in. But, you know, that's when I kind of started saying, you know what, I think I'm going to do this art now more serious, and I think it's going to be for a different reason. I think it's, so, you know, that's kind of what all culminated that.
Yeah.